This is Tim Murdoch. You're watching Endgame Exotica, exclusive interview series of White Rabbit Radio. And this is Greg Conte. He's today's guest, and he hasn't been on in a minute. He's a very famous prognosticator over there on Twitter these days. He's on Twitter and Telegram. Telegram's the link in the description, and I will throw up his X account because I didn't know he was back on there until he jumped on with me here a few minutes ago. How you doing today, Greg?
Good. Happy May Day, Tim. It's International Workers' Day. Are you celebrating?
Well, you know, I saw them out there chaining themselves to the New York Stock Exchange. Did you see that?
I didn't see that in particular, but I did see that there's a general strike called for today, which is kind of like, well, it just kind of speaks to how dead end, I don't know, the socialist or communist movement is in America. Like what workers are doing a general strike? It's I don't know, just like empty rhetoric.
Yeah, there was some pretty
violent
May Days over on I guess it were over in Europe were the violent ones, but typically the left in Europe is way more crazy than the left here, actually.
Yeah, a bit more energetic.
Everything, it seems to be. The nationalists are out on the street. I don't know. But hold on here. Let's give an audience a little overview of what they can find on Telegram. It's Telegram's links in the description, and the X link is up as well in the chats, all the different chats. I just put it up there. Let's play this. This is one of Greg is famous for doing these, I guess. When did you start doing these? Hold on.
I did a few of these short videos back in 2024, and then I stopped for most of last year because I was writing a book, but I recently did a series of them for April because I have decided that April is when I'm going to celebrate anti-Semite Appreciation Month. And so that I was appreciating the great anti-Semites of the past. And I think it's kind of a, it is frankly a silly advertising gimmick, but I'm trying to really drive the discussion in the direction of it is Jews. You know, the left wants to say, well, it's just Zionists, or the right wants to say, well, it's just, whatever their cope of the day is, but trying to drive in the direction of it is Jews. You cannot have a Jew in your political organization and hope to oppose the existing system. So, you know, you got to be aware of how this works. And I think some of these videos help do that.
Yeah, well, let's play it, and then you can comment more afterwards. I want to know more about this book. Okay, hold on. Let me make sure I got the podcast.
Most people give up after their country is destroyed, but some fight even harder. A battle-hardened officer, Otto Ernst Rehmer, is famous for crushing the July 20th plot.
Are you a dedicated National Socialist, Major?
Do you recognize my voice?
Yes, my Führer.
But did you know he was also a dedicated anti-Semite? After 1945, Rehmer started a political party to liberate Germany from Tsar. He later went to Egypt to help them defend themselves against Israeli aggression. He also recognized the fundamental importance of winning the moral argument against the Jews' disgusting slanders. Convicted of denying the Holocaust at age 80, he continued speaking the truth until his death in 1997.
Who's your favorite National Socialist? Is this your favorite?
He's one of my favorite. I have to say he's definitely one of my favorite because I guess because I see a lot of myself and my father in him. Like this is the guy I should have been in a normal society. I should have just been like a mid-level officer or government bureaucrat. And so, you know, that's exactly what he was. And he found himself in an extraordinary situation in July of 1944. And, you know, he used his basic just training and instincts to deal with an incredibly messed up scenario with, you know, the whole like attempt to overthrow the German government. And the other thing that's great about Rehmer is he gives you the like the story of what happens if you continue fighting against the Jewish system, not in the context of being like a uniformed Wehrmacht or SS officer. You know, a lot of people like to kind of look at like Sepp Dietrich or a Joachim Piper. I mean, these guys are obviously awesome. But the great thing about Raymer is it kind of shows, all right, well, now that you don't have that like political organization, that highly disciplined organization to be a part of, what do you do? And he obviously did a lot of different stuff. He, like I said in the video, you know, he tried to do a political party, he tried going to the Middle East, he tried going all over the place, and he was doing it for 50 years after the war and was connected with a lot of interesting people. And, you know, it's easy to fight when you're part of like a disciplined organization and you get some kind of reward or you get some kind of status and recognition or you get some kind of at least acknowledgement for what you're doing. It's much harder when you're not part of that. And I think that's a good lesson for a lot of us today.
Yeah. What, you know, I read some about his time in Egypt. How long was he in Egypt for?
I don't know. I actually haven't really found much about his time in Egypt or anything after the war. I mean, he's mentioned in a lot of books on Germany and like what his attempts to do a political party there. But the only thing I've really found on him in Egypt is a CIA document saying that he arrived in Egypt, his passport was out of order, and he went to Heliopolis to a place of entertainment and apparently got belligerently drunk and had to get arrested. And I don't know what that was all about, but that's what the CIA document said. But I don't know anything else about him other than, I mean, I guess at some point he had some relationship with Nasser, and he was later, he did figure out a way to sell arms to the Algerian rebels who were fighting against the French. I'm not sure I agree with that particular thing, but I think he was just doing it out of maybe a little bit of vindictiveness.
Intriguing.
But I'm curious. Yeah. What do you know about him in Egypt? Is there anything more? I don't think it's been researched really.
It's been a long time, but there was several National Socialist Party members. I'm pretty sure they were all party members, but I could be wrong about that. The internal politics of National Socialism, not everyone was an actual party member, you know what I mean?
Right.
But there were several that ended up in Egypt.
Lears was one.
Yes.
Von Lears.
They were also a couple famous intelligence operatives from National Socialism that end up running the Middle East desk in the Soviet Union. Something
didn't
along those lines, yeah. Well, we know very little about the post-war survivors. People think we do. We know very little about the ones in Argentina, the ones that went into South America. There's a lot of mysteries. There are a lot of mysteries of the ones that made it to Brazil and Paraguay. I mean, there's things we know, there's things we don't know, and I'm trying to remember. And then the ones to the Middle East pretty much remain somewhat of a mystery, but there were several that went there.
Yeah, there's a lot of it is because the books, if books exist, they're in German. And like, for instance, Hans-Ulrich Rudel has a book called Trotzdem, Nevertheless. And the first half of it covers the war. That's been translated into English. But the second half of it covers all of his adventures after the war, and it's much more political, and that's not been translated. And same thing with Raymer. His two books aren't translated. I have one of his books, but he doesn't talk about his time in Egypt. I don't think he ever wrote an autobiography. If he did, it's only in manuscript form. So, yeah, nobody really knows this stuff. I mean, nobody's really done the research on it, as far as I know. It's mostly just been, if anybody's done research on the Germans in the Middle East, it's been in the time of the war and not so much after the war. It's like sort of it's mentioned as a story, but it's never, there's very little hard information you'd actually have, and obviously very little interest from modern academics of actually looking this stuff up and.
Yeah. There's always when it comes to Egypt, you have one of my favorite National Socialists is Hess, as people know. And there's a connection between Hess and Egypt. You know, he's kind of
I didn't know that.
Cosmopolitan, raised in all these different places.
Oh, yes, he was born in Egypt, that's right.
Yeah, so, I mean, I forget how many languages the guy spoke, but he was interesting. But there was all kinds of, I just did a brief search to see exactly what has been coming out in the last 10 years, because I don't read regular media, obviously, because it won't tell us the truth, but there's a lot of mysteries. Nazi influence in Egypt, Cairo teamed with Hitler's henchmen after the Second World War, that's true, and their legacy may even persist today. Yeah. The German military advisors in Egypt, 1949 to 1967. This is Ken Ross, which is this is out of London. I've never heard of this book.
Oh, Ken Ross. Yeah, I've heard the name. He wrote a book. He wrote a biography of Ataturk. I know.
Nazis on the Nile. I wonder if it's any good.
Yeah, no, that looks really interesting. I didn't know about that.
Well, it is recent. It looks to be. Yeah, here's the thing. No. There's so much coming out of the Soviet Union after the Berlin Wall, and there's so many. We have all kinds of files that still haven't been opened in the U.S. Probably.
Go ahead. Sorry. Yeah, you could. I don't know. You could probably go and research. Yes, CIA files and stuff. No, I was on Ken Ross. No, that I'm thinking of Lord Ken Ross, who wrote a book about the Ottoman Empire. Vivian Ken Ross. Maybe that's his. Wife or something, or daughter.
I'm going to look at this. Nazis on the Nile, the German military advisors in Egypt, 1949-1967. This is hard copy. Okay, so the reason they're writing this on The Spectator, which I didn't know about, is this is a book that has come out in the last 4 years. It's out of London. All right. Using official British classified records and CIA files. Released under Nazi... Go ahead.
Oh yeah, what needs to be done is I bet there's a bunch of documents in Arabic sitting in files in Cairo and in Damascus. You know, that's what needs to be done. But yeah.
I was gonna read this really quick to see if it rings any bells, because to be honest with you, this is probably the most recent book on the subject, but he's using CIA files and British records. Released under Nazi War Crimes Disclosure Acts, Ken Ross paints a compelling portrait of a country rearming and re-equipping for the Cold War and Rocket Age with the help of former German Wehrmacht soldiers, missile scientists, and chemical engineers. We know that's true. Arms manufacturers and arms dealers. German Special Forces veterans trained Egypt soldiers to fight British in the Suez Canal Zone and the Israelis in Gaza. That's true. If they had been given executive authority and battlefield command, German commanders might have changed outcomes in Egypt's favor. Well, that's kind of interesting. I would agree, probably. The British detected German tactics of subversion in Egyptian foreign policy, propaganda, intelligence operations. Egypt used coercive methods to persuade its Jewish population to leave after the Suez Canal of 1956. I don't know anything about the Jewish population of Egypt leaving after 56. That's not something I've ever read about. And the Nazi involvement using, you know, I guess, I don't know. We'd have to have some experts on our side look at the book and see how much bullshit is in it, because you know it's going to be written from bias, of course.
But yeah, I'm aware that the Jews got pushed out of Egypt after 56, after the Suez Crisis. But, you know, I mean, they were also kind of being pushed out after 48. And, you know, you had things like the Levant Affair, where the Jews were getting doing spying in Egypt and stuff. So it's like, yeah, you're going to get kicked out when you're not welcome. And same thing happened in a lot of, you know, Iraq and Syria and everything like that.
Yeah, now it looks like the U.S. themselves, half the Middle East, the Shia part wants to kick us out of the Middle East. So, you know, back to the basics.
Well, the Sunni part does too. It's just not the Sunni governments.
That's the Arab Street always wants us out. I just wonder if we leave, how much civil war we'd see between the Sunni and Shia elements. Not because of the average man on the street, but because of the elites, especially on the Sunni side, the Abraham Accords and the fact that they're in bed with Israel and probably can. I mean, the Arab Street has always maintained they can migrate there, take a blood test and migrate. I don't know if it's true. We've never seen it proven that basically that they're Middle Eastern Jews posing as Arabs and the head of Sunni Islam. It's corrupt.
Oh, you mean the Sunnis?
The House of Saud.
I mean, I think what Sunni Shiite, the Sunni Shiite split is really just a kind of, you have a number of splits within the Middle East. So you've got the main one, the like ancient one that's been going on for thousands of years, is the difference between the desert people and the settled people. So your Mesopotamians, Syrians, and Egyptians are kind of settled people. And then you've got the desert Bedouin people, like in Saudi, you know, Arabia and elsewhere, where there's like big desert areas. And they have a very different mentality in each of those two groups. And then the Sunni Shiite split kind of, it sort of follows this, you know, some ways there's correlations there. Like the Shiites of Iran and much of Iraq would be of the settled type. And you have a big Shiite block in Yemen. But, and Egypt was actually for a few hundred years there ruled by Shiites, but it's mostly Sunni. So it's complicated. And I mean, there is a sort of superficial similarity between Judaism and Sunni Islam, just in that they're both like more radically monotheistic. I mean, Judaism, we can't really take seriously as a religion. So even that's sort of a superficial way of saying it. But Sunni Islam is more, I think it's fair to say that Sunni Islam is more like Protestantism and Shiite Islam is a little bit more like Catholicism. Like it just in terms of their folk practices and general beliefs, but it's not a perfect analogy.
I never really thought about the differences between the city and the desert dwellers, because I see there's so much crossover between the, for instance, the Houthis, I would probably categorize them more as desert than city people by and large.
For sure.
Which are the only there are Shia in Iraq that we could classify as that, and probably in Syria as well, but we couldn't, the Shia Crescent, of course, in Lebanon, we couldn't qualify them as desert.
Right. I mean, well, most of the Shiites are in Syria are more in like the settled areas, that the areas that can be agricultural. And the Yemen is like slightly more able to be to have agriculture than the rest of Arabia. And in like their ancient times, they did have like very good dam building and water distribution. So they have always been kind of a little bit more of a settled people in the Yemen than, you know, throughout like the Hejaz or much of, you know, the rest of Saudi Arabia. But it's a loose correlation. You know, it's not perfect. There's definitely Shiites who are more of the Bedouin type and Sunnis who are more of the settled type.
But the Middle East itself, though, is 50-50, whereas global Islam is like 80-20, 85-15, depending on who you ask.
Sunni Shiite.
Yeah, but the Middle East is 50-50, and that's always a recipe for some type of political quagmire or conflict.
I didn't realize that, but that actually makes sense, just because Indonesia, Pakistan, being Sunnite. Yeah.
Yeah. The Middle East is where you have the big Shia population. Most people don't know that because they always present Iran is out for themselves, obviously. They're out for Persia, but they always present Iran as like these leaders of terrorism on the planet, stuff like that. And granted, they can do the asymmetrical warfare. They're not stupid, obviously. I'm sure they could. God only knows what they have in our country or Europe. I mean, you know, they've been planning this war forever, and obviously they planned effectively to some extent to defend themselves. But they're always presented as the Shia are, you know, the Hezbollahs, the Iranians, the IRGC, they're the cornerstone of Islamic terror on the planet. The problem is when you do the numbers, it's like coming from the Sunni side by and large. I mean, the Shia don't really run around the planet like the Sunnis. They just don't have the numbers. They have the big numbers in the Middle East, but outside the Middle East, they don't really have numbers outside of Dearborn, Michigan, and whatever, 70,000.
Yeah, right. No, it's interesting about what you said about Iran planning for the war. It's been 47 years, I think, since the Islamic Revolution in Iran. And it's very interesting how much the Iranian state has developed and how much more organized they are than they were in the past. And I think they have been very astute students of Zog warfare, just like the Chinese and the Russians have. and they've figured out how to counter Zog's subversion, whether it be espionage or blockades, like economic and sub-lethal or low-level lethal warfare, very well. And yeah, it's they're much more, you know, it goes back to Clausewitz's equation that resistance power equals available means times willpower. And the biggest component of willpower in fighting a war, especially today, is your legitimacy. Like, do you seem to be doing the right thing? Not only do you seem that way to your own domestic population, but do you seem that way to the whole world? Do you seem that way to the population of the country that's fighting you? And in the case of the U.S., most people in the U.S., given the popularity or not popularity of the war with Iran, see Iran's position as much more legitimate than the U.S.'s. So it's no surprise that the Iranians, they've managed to maintain much higher combat power than would be expected, given that they are, you know, still in terms of material means, in terms of planes and troops and whatever, generally inferior to the U.S., although there's, you know, certainly in terms of missiles, they seem to be superior. But they've really figured out a way to fight the U.S. in a war and preserve their own sovereignty, which is impressive.
Yeah, well, the U.S., they are fighting Clausewitz. They're definitely pulling out the book, but the U.S. uses that particular manual for finance. So the U.S. is trying to fight a financial war, and they're trying to run Clausewitz vis-a-vis financial markets, which is what the English-speaking world really does with their empire.
Yeah.
I say the English-speaking world because I'm talking about, you know, the Five Eyes with Israel, maybe the Six Eyes Jews,
yeah,
basically. But they're running von Clausewitz. They're running Clausewitz, but it's really applied to financial. Bessent's in there, you know, shutting them down. They're trying to strangle them by shutting down the straits. They're really trying to, you know, the Iranians were running their particular game extremely well, like, come and get us. And the U.S. was trying that, but it didn't go so well. We got all our bases wiped out, and all these Arab partners were just getting hammered, and Israel got hammered. We just don't know the extent of Israel getting hammered, but we know they got hammered. And then the U.S. turned around like, well, we got to run von Kla- we got to run. We can't win this, so we're going to have to run the financial side of the equation, which I'm surprised they didn't go with to begin with.
Well, I think they did go with that to begin with. I think just their own stupidity and arrogance led them to try to escalate force against Iran.
It was the Jews. And,
yeah, well, the Jews, right. Yeah. The Jews were telling
arrogant.
Them.
Arrogant. Yeah.
The Jews were like, yo, you can do this. Like, just take out their leadership and it'll all be over. And anybody who, I don't know, read a book on the Middle East or something, or I don't know, just had a basic understanding of what's happened in the last 20 years, last 50, 100 years, would say, well, if you're going to attack Iran, this country is way stronger than it was back in 1980. And even in 1980, you know, the U.S. pushed the Iraqis to invade, do a conventional invasion of Iran. And that obviously had a very low probability of success just because the Iraqi army was not the Wehrmacht. It was a crudely organized, very badly trained and poorly motivated force. And you've got, I think it's 800 miles from Baghdad to Tehran, and two thirds or three quarters of that is in Iran. And you have to go over the Zardoz Mountains, and that's just not going to work. And so same thing with the U.S. now, thinking back in, February, March, when they launched the attack early March, or the very end of February, and they didn't think, oh, well, you know, we can't possibly achieve air superiority, air dominance over Iran. And even if we could, we couldn't possibly take out all of their missile launch sites. And even if we could, we're not going to topple the government. And we've already tried all of the gay ops, all the financial stuff. They've been blockaded or been under some kind of financial sanctions
for years,
decades, right? Yeah. So I don't know what they were thinking. I mean, my thinking back in February was like, seeing where they were putting the aircraft carriers and where they had the planes, just with I don't know, a purely amateur understanding of this, I was like, okay, Zog is lying that they're going to attack Iran. They're going for the fake out, because that's what I would do if I was in their situation. They're going for the fake out. They're actually just going to turn all that shit and go hit Yemen or like Palestine or something. Like, that would kind of make more sense, because at least those are potentially achievable objectives, to try to hammer the Yemen with like all of your planes and aircraft carriers, missiles, everything.
You could probably take them out.
You could at least severely degrade them. And in that situation, at least you're putting the Iranians in an impossible situation where they have to decide, okay, do I get into the fight and then try to, you know, because it's like your little brother is getting beaten up. Do you go and you protect your little brother? Well, you kind of have to. And then Zog in that situation can say, oh, Iran is aggressive. They're the ones who are attacking us, even though Zog is attacking the Yemen. But, you know, they didn't even attempt that. They just went straight for Iran. They thought after Venezuela, I think, that we have the biggest dicks and we can just do what we want. And
I'm surprised they didn't, now that you mentioned it, because the Saudis had such a tough time. They've never really been able to do anything with the Houthis, not much at least. I'm surprised that the Empire didn't try to take them out first, because then it would – the Houthis are a problem because no one knows really what they have. I'm not comfortable saying we know what they have after seeing what Iran's done. What the Houthis have buried, ready to fire to close down another strait. So you'd think that would be like, okay, we're going to just crush these people or try to. And if we're going to invade somewhere, we'll invade there and see how it goes. Because it's not going to be – I mean, they're not – it's not Iran. You at least have some things going for you. Now, it's going to be ugly, but you think they would – so your plan is pretty good. You think they would –
think about it, right? Like, if you have a to use a Middle Eastern metaphor, if you have like a tea set sitting in the middle of a big Persian rug, right? How do you get to the tea set without stepping on the rug? You roll up the rug, right? You don't just go in and grab the tea set. You roll up the rug. So you attack from the outside in. And that's what Zog always does. It's what they do with dissident groups in the US too. They attack the people on the fringes. Like if you went to a meeting or something, well, the FBI is going to go visit you. They do that first in order to go after the people who are more serious about opposing the system. So I would think they would just apply the same reasoning, but
they
don't know.
After
they got
the head of the snake, as they say, and the problem was that those people have been prepared for it for decades.
Yeah,
preparing. I still remember after September 11th. I've told this story before, but there was groups in restaurant owners, very well known restaurant owners, that were being accused of supporting Hezbollah. They were Lebanese restaurant owners, very successful. One famous one, I think, was a restaurant called Lashish, very famous in the area, meaning they're very well to do, had a couple, one of probably the first successful Arabic restaurants in metropolitan Detroit, if you will. But I remember this one of the owners, brothers or co-owners, whatever, was accused of quote unquote supporting terrorism. Now the challenge with that is that after September 11th, the neocons, Jews, basically made it, Hezbollah became formally a terrorist organization sometime after that. However, whatever the date was, I don't know. So they start cracking down on all these particular Lebanese, and Hezbollah runs like everything in Lebanon that's Shia, like everything, kindergarten to the old folks' homes to everything. So by default, if you're Shia from Lebanon, you're supporting Hezbollah, whether you're not, even if you just breathe or go to the hospital. So basically what I remember, though, is when they started cracking down, investigating those guys, there were several that just said, fuck you, and they left the country, left mortgages and everything, sent money out and said, just left. They didn't fight it. They just said, fuck the U.S. government, and they left. And that's kind of the attitude that I think we're seeing from Iran in a nutshell. It's like, okay, I'll go back to Iran, my farm in Iran, which, you know, the whole entire reason in here is because I've had to rebuild it a dozen times, but I'll go back and rebuild it a dozen more. Fuck you. I'm not putting up with this. And now maybe they wanted to arrest some of them as well, and they got away before. Who knows?
Well, Tim, what did you think of the whatever happened near Isfahan with all those aircraft and helicopters? What was that? It was about a month ago. You remember the They were rescuing the downed American pilot. Was that what they were actually doing?
I don't know how the history is going to be written. I think they probably, that was the beginning of some type of ground situation, and they were going to go after the nuclear whatever material first, or they were doing something related to that. And that was some type of, obviously, they were deep inside Iran. And the only logical explanation based on location would have been something after that nuclear fuel or that particular place. And I think it went sideways. And when it went sideways, it became a rescue operation and they couldn't start whatever invasion they wanted to start or whatever, you know, whatever.
That was basically my assessment too. Because in the couple days leading up to that, there was all this like air activity over southern Iran. And they're like, oh, we're looking for the pilot. And he's in, I forget the name of the province, but it's somewhere in southern Iran. It's basically right between Kuwait and Isfahan. And it just strikes me that that's the perfect explanation for if you are flying a bunch of stuff over. Yeah, thank you. Excellent map. Yeah, if you're flying a bunch of stuff over, let's call it, the area to the slight southwest of Isfahan, well, you need an explanation for it. And you say, oh, we're looking for the downed pilot. But then you have a bunch of stuff on the ground that's within about, I think it was 50 minutes by truck from the main Iranian nuclear facility. And it's in the middle of the desert. And there's a mountain, like a big
obstacle between you. It's in the middle of freaking nowhere.
Yeah, it's like it seems kind of like more. I mean, and also because you're risking all of these assets to go pick up this guy, allegedly you're picking up this pilot. Well, you're risking all the helicopters, all the C-130s, everything to go get that guy and, you know, potentially massively increasing your problem because now you have more downed aircraft, more lost pilots and personnel. It seems like that was just a pretext to go do something else. And yeah, I think there was, I agree. I think it was just a debacle and they've covered it up fairly, you know, effectively by saying, yeah, look, we got the pilot, but where's the pilot? How come he's not on the front page of the New York Times? Where's the guy? Who's the guy you got allegedly?
Yeah, it's a problem. And we're just kind of like using common sense to piece it together. The buildup in front of that, I think was too much just for one little special forces. Well, it wasn't little special forces. It was a full-blown large special forces operation. But let's face it, the buildup in and around in front of that date was quite large.
Yeah.
I would like to know how many guys got killed on the bases and what the true American losses are, because Iran said today, they came out and said it was, who's their main guy now? It starts with an A.
Oh, Akarji, I think.
Is that how it's pronounced? Aragachi or something?
I'm not a Persianist, but let me. Yeah,
Aragachi.
But he's the foreign minister. Yeah,
he's the foreign minister. Said that the U.S. Financial losses are every inch of 100 billion, with collateral losses being probably 500 billion on economy and stuff like that. And I don't know if that's all accurate, but it's a lot worse than the U.S. government's saying. So I'm curious on what comes out as far as the troop losses and what was going on those bases, because they were just getting hammered. And we have all these drones doing pinpoint hits on various different hotels around the Middle East in the Gulf, ally places like Dubai, so on and so forth. They're doing pinpoint hits on floors and they have to be taking out somebody. And that's not for show. You know, they were targeting what they said was our personnel coming into the area. You know.
Yeah.
So I'm curious to know what the actual casualties are for the U.S. right now. And what are the actual casualties for the Israelis?
Right. And it's, you have to assume with Zog that they're lying about everything, because you just put yourself in their position when you're a bunch of incompetent idiots and you know that the people hate you. When you have a military debacle, the calculation that goes through your head and the thing that you tell everybody around you is, well, this is a matter of national security. that we have to preserve morale. There's words that they use. It's probably something like that. We need to preserve civilian morale, and so therefore we have to say this is what happened. There, like, when, I guess, when has Zog ever leveled with you? You know, like, if you're running a company or a small sports team or something, there's going to be times where bad things happen and you go to your subordinates and you say, look, we fucked up. This is a problem. This is what we need to do to fix it. And that's kind of how I think most people think about these things. You think, if I was in their position, I would just admit that we fucked up and this is the problem. This is the situation. We need to explain it to people. We need to get them to understand it. And then we need to move from there. But Zog does not do that. And it doesn't do it because it realizes that its legitimacy is so low right now, and it's only going to keep getting lower, that if they ever admit to a defeat or to even a minor mistake, they're going to have a revolutionary situation on their hands potentially.
Yeah. It's just, and Trump's like a perfect character in so much that he says everything's winning 24/7. So he's like one of their perfect Zog characters where you can just,
yeah,
just prop him up and he's just going
to, so,
he's going to act like he's winning even when he's getting his ass kicked.
It's so tiresome. Like, you just wish, like, just give just one time, would you please admit the truth? Would you just admit that you guys lost? And I feel like a lot of Americans would be prepared to forgive them, but they won't do that because it's an incredible risk.
Yeah. They don't know anything. They can't deal in truth. But the Isfahan debacle. And I don't know that we'll, I mean, eventually it's going to come out how many soldiers are dead or wounded, because Americans do talk, and you eventually got to tell their families, the soldiers are going to tell their families, of course, they're wounded. And the ones that are dead, the families are going to find out. So we should be putting together numbers. I just wonder what it is. Because it had to be some pretty elite troops they were going after, and they're using supposedly Russian satellite intelligence, and the Chinese were giving them everything. You know, the Iranians, that's another thing. They have legitimate partnerships. You know, the U.S. had these partnerships where we just threaten these countries. These countries are scared to death, but you can't really trust someone like that. The Iranians have partners that realize that their ass will be on the line too if Iran goes down, because, you know, Russia has,
exactly.
Russia wants them to do well, and they seem like legitimate partners, and China wants them to do well and is treating them like legitimate partners, and that makes a difference too.
Yeah, I mean, long term, this is sort of a struggle for existence between Zog on the one hand and Russia, China, and Iran on the other. And it seems like the Russians, the Iranians, and the Chinese have realized that. And, you know, the whole international situation seems to be speeding up exponentially since about 2014, since the Maidan and everything. There's just been it's been a sort of crisis. It's been like a crisis and then a de-escalation, but the de-escalation is never back to normal. So it's like two steps into crisis, okay, back down, and then another two steps into crisis, back down. And we've seen this with COVID, with October 7th, with the Iran war, this recent Iran war, but there was also the 12-day war back in June of last year. So it just keeps happening, and it's a death spiral. Zog, I don't think, actually can pull out of this. And so it's the only way that this will really end is with either a major collapse, a major political collapse of one of the three great powers, Russia, China, or the U.S., or, I suppose, nuclear war, but I think that's less, I hope that's less likely. I hope Zog collapses first.
The U.S. will look to survive. It'll look to survive at any and all costs financially.
Because
if it's reserve status, and it'll still be dominant in North and South America no matter what with reserve status. It'll still have reserve status for part of the planet. So they're going to look to survive no matter what. That'll be its goals. And that survival means financial, because, I mean, obviously no one's going to invade us directly.
Right.
I just, what I worry about is that Israel, of course, reports came out of Israel saying that Netanyahu was surprised at our incompetence. I don't know why. They pretty
much were
incompetent, because the 65 Immigration Act and all the stupid shit that they've done, social engineering.
Well, and it, more to the point, it's it's not even, I don't think it's even that. It's just because of, like, because of Jews running the country.
Yeah.
They've had this selection.
But they don't, they don't look in the mirror.
Well, in the military and the government, you've just had a selection for cowards and retards for decades now, and it keeps getting worse and worse and worse. Back in like the 40s, you had guys who had a dedication to truth, who, even though they maybe realized that the system was compromised, they still were in high positions in government. You had people like Patton, who, you know, had his problems, but a guy like Patton today would get kicked out of the army at lieutenant or lower. There's no fucking way he would get to a 3-star or 4-star general. And same thing with guys like Forrestal back in the 1940s, the minister or secretary of war, secretary of defense.
He's a badass. Back in
the Truman. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure you know about him and his opposing Israel and everything. And
yeah,
he fell out of the window at the Bethesda Naval Hospital.
Surprise.
Surprise. So, yeah, I think you just had this selection against competence because they don't – anybody who tells the truth is – even to their direct superior says, hey, sir, we're going to get fucked if we do this. Anybody that does that is a problem. And so people have learned the high – you know, as they ascend through the ranks, they learn, okay, if I want to keep going, I need to tell them what they want to hear. And so you just get this situation in the top echelons of the government where everyone's yes men. And so you're prone to these kinds of disasters, which should be a white pill to everybody. People say, oh, there's no hope, like Zog has total control. But you have to analyze the moral dimension of this whole thing. And tyrannical societies like this always fall, and they always fall for the same reason. It's their arrogance and stupidity.
Yeah, that's true. And usually they happen when no one expects it. But this is a case of them surrounding themselves in their own little bubble with a bunch of yes men. Like you say, they're like, you know, they haven't been under the normal Anglo-Saxon selection pressure that brought out the Forrestals and the Patton. That's a good point. But yeah, it's just one giant social engineering race to the bottom, but they have themselves to blame. And I have a feeling that Israel, that's the problem in Israel as well.
Yeah, well, it's right. I agree. It's
massive corruption. They can get anything they want just by looting, making a phone call, and their cousins loot something in America. So you have this massive degeneracy, massive corruption. And, I mean, Netanyahu, I guess he probably would represent the best of the Jews, but come on now.
Well, it's a very thief corrupt state. It's a robbery state.
Sure.
So
it's kind of hard. I guess it's hard to analyze a robbery straight. Even their military compared to the Israeli military during the Six-Day War, if you look at they didn't have all the gay shit. They didn't have all the weird shit. Maybe they had it behind the scenes, but you know what I mean? I mean, they're degenerate as well, far more than the ancestors coming out of World War II that were a hell of a lot tougher. I mean, they're just as criminal minded, I'm sure, but you know what I'm saying. They've been degraded too, with all the wealth. Wealth is more ruthless than war.
Victims of their own success, exactly.
Yeah. So, but they're talking about America attacking Iran again, but Iran has to have surprises held back. You got to expect that. You got to assume that. You know.
Yeah, I would assume so. And I don't really know. It's kind of the whole situation is sort of dissolved in the last 2 or 3 weeks since the truce was proclaimed. But the Israelis are still attacking in Lebanon. And, the Iranians know full well that you can't ever have a true peace with Zog because you can't have an honor. Zog has no honor. So they won't ever just do what they say they're going to do. They will. Everything is always a negotiating tactic. So
what do you think about Iran? Iran doesn't want to negotiate with Witkoff and Kushner. They want to negotiate with J.D. Vance. I guess it's the only one in their minds that maybe have something against the Iran war.
I don't think
that's
what they're doing.
Maybe that's the best of the worst. I don't know.
No, I think what they're doing is they're actually just making a reasonable demand. They're saying, Look, this guy Witkoff and Kushner, they're Jews, and they've already two times been negotiating with us, and then we've been attacked. If you're, you know, the Iranians, right?
Yeah, they get
so. Why would they already be the traitors twice? So we don't want to talk to them. We want to talk to somebody else. We want you. You have to stake somebody else's reputation in this next negotiation with us. Stake J.D. Vance, and it's actually brilliant because what that J.D. Vance, I think, is Zog's kind of fallback guy for if. He's one of their fallback options for the kind of conservative movement in the U.S., right? They're trying to position him as an alternative to Trump once Trump is no longer in office and or too old or dies or whatever. And J.D. Vance, which is why they've sort of leaked information about J.D. Vance being, oh, he's against the war or whatever. And so the Iranians very astutely have seen this. And they are like, all right, why don't you risk J.D. Vance's reputation on this next round of negotiations and then attack us and then prove that he's that he has no say either in what's actually done because he's coming to negotiate and then there's an attack. And that discredits him as well. I think that's what they're doing.
Yeah, that would be brilliant if they did that, if that was their thinking. That's kind of good analysis. I didn't have that. I didn't see that their analysis was, well, they're positioning him as against the war like an Obama during the Iraq war. And the reason they're positioning him is because if something happens, they're going to have a fallback anti-war candidate or a candidate that seems like he was against Iran war, which is what they did with Obama in the Iraq war.
What they did with Trump too, back in 2016, the seeming anti-war guy, right?
Yeah, 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 yeah. Well, they like to position on both sides. There's a reason for it.
100%.
Populations buy into this stuff. Oh, okay. J.D. Vance was the anti-war candidate. We'll vote for him. He's less extreme. So that is that's brilliant analysis by Iran. If that's why they're doing that, they're trying to get him in there because for one, he's not actually Jewish, and they're trying to see what he's about.
They're trying to angle Washington into a impossible situation. Washington doesn't want to risk J.D. Vance's reputation as the anti-war guy.
It's interesting. Yeah, Hezbollah is of course fascinating because Hezbollah, you might remember when they had the massive pager attack. Israelis did that crazy shit. And a lot of people thought it was over with, but they don't understand that these groups were built up, you know, who knows? Some say five deep, but who knows how many leaders you could take out and still end up with all these cells fighting you with all kinds of advanced weapons or weapons advanced enough to wreak havoc.
Yeah, I mean, these are battle-hardened groups. They've been selected for over decades on the basis of Hitlerian idealism, willingness to sacrifice, you know. Yeah. So yeah, they're the antithesis, they're the inverse of Zog. In Zog, everyone's selected for in leadership on the basis of mercantile like grift, and among Hezbollah it's on the basis of your warrior ethos. So yeah, you kill off 100 of them or 500 of them, and the next round just steps up. Young guys take their spot.
What is your opinion on the FPV drones in Hezbollah that's giving? We don't really know numbers on how bad it is for Israel and these young soldiers cruising through there, but any given moment they're getting taken out. It's just a fact.
I've seen a few of those videos. I don't know much about it. It's impressive that Hezbollah has adopted this technology. It would stand to reason that they've at least been paying attention to the war in Ukraine, unlike the U.S. Army, and they've taken some lessons from it, gained some competencies from it, whether it be directly from the Russians or maybe just emulating it, just researching it and putting it together themselves.
It's probably from Iran as well.
Yeah, right.
Iran, Russia, too. China. You know.
Yeah, and the Israelis don't seem to have adopted their doctrine at all. I mean, you had a couple ambushes there with the Israelis sending in tank columns unsupported by infantry. I don't know. Is that like a thing that they do that they think is smart? And I mean, it's dumb it was dumb and accepted that you don't do that in 1918 or 1943. To do that today, especially with, you know, not only infantry, but drones being another way to attack tanks, it just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, this is one where the Israeli Defense Force is testing a folded anti-drone net installed on a Humvee. I don't know how this stuff's going to work for them, though. You can see that it's like a giant net around it that can get the drone before it comes in. But I think there's probably a way around this. They're trying to fly drones.
Well, yeah, it's the same thing like with – correct me if I'm wrong, but RPGs, isn't the whole technology is like if you shoot out – if you shoot two RPGs at something, the first one blasts through the armor, the second one hits the target. I mean, it's the same thing with drones. You know, you can put a net or an extra shell on your tank, and you could have the sort of the armor that they did like in World War II, where you have like an outside shell over the tank. But if you just have two missiles hit the same spot, you penetrate.
Yeah, they're having a problem with these FPV drones, and FPV drones are attached to a wire. You know, and that wire, you know, that's how they're hitting them. You can't really do much to block them. They're like guided cruisers coming in and wreaking havoc. And, you know, I am amazed that they've been able to, I'm amazed that we can't get more data on how many Jewish soldiers are hurt, you know.
Yeah, well, that's the one thing that Zog has realized since World War I is that maintaining civilian morale by denying casualties and using propaganda to demonize the enemy is the only way that you, as a Jewish democracy, stay in a war. So they're just playing this. They're just doing the same thing they've been doing for 100 years, and it's working less and less.
Yeah, Iran open to diplomacy if U.S. drops its excessive demands. Well, it's not the U.S., obviously, it's Israel, and they know that. Their demands are basically to roll over and die, from the looks of things to me. They're not going to...
Typical Jewish effrontery, chutzpah.
Yeah, I just don't see how this ends well. I don't see how they don't go back at it eventually, because they're not going to settle for anything other than the removal of the IRGC and the removal of the Iranian regime. Israel has to have that in their mind to survive. And so they're going all in. They prepared to go all in. How much do you think they're going to sacrifice over this? Maybe this may be the one that takes them out?
I think that's a distinct possibility. Yeah, I think the Jews, you can't take their framing of it as true. They don't need to do this to survive. That's what they say. They always say that we need to do this to survive.
Well, that's actually how they think, though. If we don't get them, they're going to get us. And it's really just this neurotic. It's a neurotic psychosis where they end up in this locked battle to the death. These locked negotiations.
Right. Yeah, they could just calm down and just be decent people and abide by agreements. But because they're a collective of several million, 6 million, 8 million, well, it's usually 6 million Jews in one spot, they can't, like, the leader of the Jews can't do that, because all the other Jews are going to be like, oh, you agreed to this. Now you're a horrible person. They're going to throw him in prison. So he's like in an impossible situation. He goes to jail. Well, next Jew steps up. Okay. Well, they're going to have to do the same thing. Like, yeah, this is sort of it's like a law of physics. Jews will always push for more.
Yeah. There's no way to, you would think that they would just say, you know, let's just treat this like a Cold War. In the Middle East and between the Shia and the Sunni, and we'll win it like the Cold War. And they got into this open confrontation, and you know it was going to be bad, because when did they go at it with Hezbollah the first time? It was bad news. It was 2006.
Yeah, I think it was 2006.
And they were getting lit up. The Hezbollah was lighting up their tank columns with shoulder-guided missiles that they got from Russia and Iran. Maybe right. Some more Chinese as well through Iran, whatever. And they were doing quite a number, and we could never get any accurate numbers out of that, other than it was obviously bad. And so they wanted some rematch, and they lined up the rematch based on some pager stunt and a lot of trickery and ghoulish horror flick type stuff on the world stage. And now they're in there, and they're getting hammered.
Yeah, I would love to see, after this is all over, maybe in 20, 50, or 100 years, I would love to see someone needs to write a history of the planning process that went into October 7th. How did Hezbollah do that? Because it was like the Schlieffen plan. It was like, genius.
Hamas?
Hamas. Yeah. Okay. How did Hamas pull that off? Like, how did they get the training? How did they get the equipment? How did they put it together? How did they do it all in secret? You know, it must have been absolute, you know, genius for them to do it. And I would love to see how they put that all together. But I don't think we'll know for a long time.
Yeah, it's a great question. I don't know any of the official versions. I just assume the Iranians helped them and Hezbollah next door helped them. You're usually, to pull off something like that, you're either going to, they do have wealthy benefactors, but those wealthy benefactors are behind actual states. So what foreign intelligence services actually help them as well? Because you're going to have to be trained to do some of that stuff, and you're not going to be able to train in a prison state of Gaza.
Exactly.
I guess you could do some training underground, okay, but you're not going to be able to fly a hang glider.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can only like do computer simulations and sand table rehearsals so many times. You got to have some guys actually go to a place like Iran and just practice flying lawnmower engine powered flying machines, whatever those are called. You know,
I would imagine it was there. You might be able to do something in Syria and Iraq because of the control they had there. And Hezbollah, of course, is there as well. And we know that Hezbollah and Hamas have talked, maybe not during their whole entire existence, but over the past decade for sure. And so you would assume that it had something to do with someone helped them. But the whole story would be quite intriguing. I just don't know what it would be, how it's going to end up. But this current situation with Hezbollah, what do you think Israelis' objectives are? I mean, I know what they say, but they obviously want the Litani River. They want to take it to the river. They want to split Lebanon in half, maybe?
On Lebanon, I don't know in particular what their objectives are always maximalist, and their objectives throughout the Middle East are either to control every government through the Mossad, through the CIA, through money, through corruption, through espionage, and failing that, to break up every country. I think they want to break up Iran the way that they they did break up Syria, and that they've kind of broken up Iraq.
Yeah.
You know, Iraq is still marked on the map as a full country, and probably the Shiite 60% of southern and central Iraq is more or less one political entity. But, you know, I don't think the Baghdad government, the Baghdad government certainly doesn't control Kurdistan. And I think they only have some loose control in the Sunni areas, if any.
Yeah, they don't talk about breaking up any of their Sunni partners' countries. but what do you make of hold on, let me pull up something here. Jews in Argentina. What do you make of Israel, basically talks of them? Well, they're obviously in Cyprus. They've made a case for Cyprus and doing more things with Greece. And so they're constantly, Argentina has come up. You know, Malay, they own him. He's like Trump Jr. or something down there.
Are you referring to Patagonia and the fires in particular?
Yeah, I know you know about that. I think it's somewhat speculative. There's been a rising number of elites from the Soroses to even like George Bush that are rumored to own. Well, actually, some do own land down there. But then you have these Jewish soldiers that have been coming in there on furlough and whatnot, cruising around there. And then, of course, they got caught lighting the fires, and you had the protests over it. I just wonder exactly if Argentina is part of a fallback plan, because you have America that's, you know, as it is right now, Zog is going to dominate North and South America, if anything. And I wonder if that's their big fallback strategy, because I have a feeling it was something to do with Ukraine as well at one time.
If it is their fallback strategy, I think it's too little too late. I think their arrogance in the Near East and in the United States and the West in general have put them in a situation where they can't develop. If they are trying to build a colony in Patagonia, they don't really have the time to do it. I think, and same thing with the Ukraine, I don't think the Jews want to, I think Patagonia is much more likely than the Ukraine. I don't think they want to inhabit the Ukraine. It's a country that's right on the border between two great power blocks, you know, Russia and the United States. And even if, you know, it's always a dangerous situation to be running the Ukraine, and there's just not really it's not a defensible position in any way. So it doesn't really make sense to try to colonize Ukraine. Colonizing Patagonia would make some sense, but I think with Jews, it's sort of, I don't think they really think that far ahead. You know, I don't want to underestimate my enemy here, but I don't think they think too far ahead. I think a lot of what's going on in Patagonia is just standard Jewish scamming to buy up land to make money.
Yeah, keep it.
They could transition that. They could transition that into like a kind of fallback plan for if they get pushed out of Israel or whatever. But I think they've miscalculated, because I don't think they have the time to do that if things continue moving very quickly.
This is a good point. That they're going to go into Argentina basically to loot and to buy and sell stuff. But I don't know. It looks like a full. I think the United States itself is a fallback plan as well if something happens. But they're not going to leave unless they absolutely positively have.
Yeah, the problem with the U.S., though, is that they've been, the anti-Semitism among Americans has just been spiking. It's shocking to me, even, you know, that I just talk to people I know, different class backgrounds, different professions, different, you know, educations, political feeling, different races, and the knowing is out of control. And not just the knowing that it's the Jews who run the U.S., which is something that was still sort of was a very controversial topic 5 or 10 years ago. That's almost taken for granted. People are even getting anti-Semitism on a much more basic level, or a much more developed level. They're understanding, oh, Jews always tend to do this, Jews always tend to do that. Here's what you can do when the Jews are attacking you, oppressing you. Like, the understanding of politics in Americans particularly, I think, has been developing. It's not nearly what it needs to be, but the progress, the improvement is marked.
Yeah. As anti-Semitism spirals, democracies must act now. They're writing articles like a dime a dozen every other day about anti-Semitism. They had an incident in the UK in Golden Green or something like that, where some Jews got stabbed or almost got stabbed. And now they're allocating another 20 million British pounds sterling toward protecting the Jews. And the Jews are they're demanding all this protection from these people they own, but these people they own can't really protect them.
Yeah, and it's the same thing they've been doing in the U.S. for forever. But, you know, especially since 9/11, just allocating money to security of synagogues, which, you know, no doubt is just embezzled by Jewish security firms. I mean, you know, they do a little bit, but mostly it's just handouts for Jews under the auspices of security. It's the same shit.
Yes. As anti-Semitism spirals, democracies must act now. They're making all these demands, but what are people supposed to do? There's nothing they can do. I mean, in UK, it's what, like 25% or 50%? You know, they come out with these numbers. But when did you first learn about the Jews? How many years has it been back?
2014. You know, that to really give the mark where I was like, all right, these people are clearly way more powerful than they should be, was 2014. And you kind of break the brainwashing, break the conditioning of thinking, well, Jews, it's are just oppressed or something like that. And it was, you know, it was a real epiphany for me. It was November of 2014, and it's kind of like, whoa.
So that was the evil of the alt-right. That was when the alt-right started booming.
Yeah, and you have to, like, it takes, you know, it really does take months or even years to rebuild after that happens, because you've built up your entire world concept on certain presuppositions, and you know, a lot of which are still true. But then when you realize that the people who are in charge are not the people that are supposedly in charge, that, like, the whole, your whole understanding of the political order has to be redone, and in many cases, your whole understanding of history and many other subjects too.
100% correct. So 2014, so about 12 years ago. So the changes you've seen, you mentioned this, alluded to it before, and that's something I've never talked to you about, which, I mean, let's face it, post October 7th, can you agree, would we agree that October 7th was like some kind of like line in the sand? In my mind, it's like after October 7th, the whole entire world is now, seems like Greg Conte in 2014.
For sure, yeah.
It's like the stuff is mushrooming. You hear people talking about Jews, because I'm no neophyte. I've heard about them my whole entire life from generally, if you're in and around Muslims, you're going to hear about Jews because right. It's constantly Lebanon or something like that. But it's like post October 7th, anti-Semitism just exploded globally. It's like the internet, memes, alt-right, white nationalism, and all this stuff out there online, all K-Mac and Duke, whoever you want to name, all this stuff over and over again online, these basic facts just exploded on the world stage.
Yeah, and I think what people need to keep in mind, though, with this is the Jews can control an entire population that is anti-Semitic. They do it in the Near East, you know. The Egypt, as we were saying earlier, the Arab street is incredibly anti-Semitic, and the Jews managed to control a lot of Arab countries, either, well, I mean, through the CIA or through Mossad or whatever. They have puppets in the Gulf countries and Egypt and so on. But so that's the first thing, is like knowing that it's the Jews isn't enough. You have to know it's the Jews and then start figuring out, you know, what's the next step? How do you push the Jews out of power in your own country so that you can be a sovereign people and not be goy slaves? That's one thing. Another thing is to understand, you know, start understanding how the Jews use money to control opposition. And I think we've been seeing this more and more as well, that people have, you know, we've seen increasingly sophisticated attempts to control the opposition by setting up fake people, doing fake things, saying fake things. And we've also seen a commensurate increase in understanding of, okay, this person's fake. Not as much as we need. Again, I mean, someone like Nick Fuentes is obviously completely fake and controlled. You're not allowed to just go punch a Jewish woman and not get thrown in prison. You know, that you or I can't do that. He can do it. Why can he do it? Well, there's probably a reason that he can do it. And it probably has to do with his whoever's paying him and what function he provides in the system of collecting opposition energy and misdirecting it. But, you know, I'm optimistic on these things. I think the Aryan man will start to see through it, and white people will start to organize themselves. We'll kind of go back to the basics, and we're going to put ourselves in a position where we actually can have sovereignty in our own countries. And, you know, October 7th was great, because it burst open the issue to all kinds of people that otherwise hadn't seen it yet. Liberals, a lot of non-whites.
I think Nick Fuentes is more of a, in my mind, he's not a revolutionary character. He's a political character. And as you said, they can deal with political characters more so than revolutionary characters. As long as you want to play within the system, they can deal with that.
Yes. Well, I see what you're saying, and I agree with you. I just wouldn't use the word political to describe Nick Fuentes. I wouldn't use it to describe anybody in Congress. I find that, like, that's an insult to political thinking and politics. Well, politics to me has a good connotation.
He's an entertainer. He's an entertainer more to me.
Yeah, well, politics, Hitler was a politician, right?
Yeah.
Nick Fuentes or anybody in Congress, they're just merchants who trade influence for money. That's what they do. So they're not even like political actors. So like, yeah, political entertainment figures, perhaps, who trade influence for money.
Yeah, I'd be interesting to see what happens with Nick the Knife. He certainly makes way. His opinions makes waves. I'm just curious on the whole entire because as anti-Semitism grows, there's going to be more and more movements and sub-movements. And the problem is when you're trying to control, like, let's say Gulf states, you're dealing with a small area where you have theocracies, and the people in charge can just arrest you and just say, you know, whatever, and cut off their heads. In America and Europe, although it is close to it, if you're a white activist, it's not quite that far. And, you know, when you first got involved, let me put it to you like this. When you first got involved, how many targets on both hands, like pro-white targets on the planet, were there really? There's not that many in 2014. There's not that many podcasters. There's not that many – shit, there's no live streamers yet. Really, there's some guys making videos, but everything's pretty rare. In 2026, you can't keep track of everything, and you can't tell the difference between one of these near mainstream YouTubers attacks on the Jews or the Zionists from anything of white nationalism in 2002 on Stormfront. Other than they're probably not pro-white, they're just anti-Semites. But it's just a totally different bill of goods. The numbers of angry people are just crazy.
Yeah. And, you know, like on people who are just anti-Semitic and aren't white nationalist, I don't look at that is a problem, but.
Well, it's not a problem for us as much as it is for the Jews.
Yeah, right. Well, the way I look at it is, you know, the delineation between are you a system person or are you actually in opposition is, do you understand the Jewish question? That's like, that is the number one thing. That is the singular thing. Do you understand that Jews run the country? Things like racial awareness, understanding that racial issues and how you need to have, you know, be pro-white and what kinds of problems we have with other races, that's kind of secondary. It's important to understand you can't just be an anti-Semite. You have to ascend to these higher levels in racial understanding and in economic understanding and in foreign policy, all these things, because you have a lot of Republicans who are anti-Semites, but who can get duped on like the China issue or the Russia issue or on economics. And same thing
like
with
Massey,
the left.
What's your opinion on Massey? Because Massey's a great example. I don't know how much of an anti-Semite he is. He's definitely against Zionism and Jewish control of the country to some
extent. Right. I don't
he's
know.
He's definitely
much,
not racialist at all. He probably, who knows what he'd do to us, but at the same time, he seems to understand something about Jewish corruption and that Zionism is bad and that Jews have too much power. He seems to have that basic down.
Yeah, well, there's a tendency, particularly in conservative politics, for people to assume or to say, well, he said this good thing, therefore he secretly believes these other things. And my position is just kind of has come to be, it doesn't matter what somebody secretly believes. It only matters what they publicly state.
Exactly.
And, you know, so yeah, he's an interesting figure for analysis, perhaps. But if he ran for president tomorrow, I would say we have to radically and fanatically oppose him.
Yeah, he's definitely not our guy. But I'm. Do you think he's going to win re-election? I think he should. I think he will versus opposition to AIPAC, or do you think AIPAC will sideline him?
I suppose he might win. That would be interesting.
I think he's going to win because the Iran war is a debacle, and a lot of people are saying Israel got us involved. It's like mainstream. So I think he could win. I don't see him as like he doesn't have strong enough opinions on anything other than AIPAC to hurt us. he's like one of these middle of the road political characters.
Well, you always have to ask yourself on a guy like him, if the pressure was on, if the FBI came to him or, you know, somebody threatened him with prison or he got sued or something, would he be able to resist the pressure? And, you know, obviously, well, you can resist a lawsuit if you have enough friends and enough money. You can resist that fairly effectively. But if you don't, lawsuits are incredibly stressful as anybody that was involved in the Charlottesville lawsuit would know. I wasn't, but I have been involved in like a criminal thing for years, and it's very stressful. I obviously didn't commit any fucking crimes. It's insulting to even have to say that, but you know, it's very stressful to get put under legal pressure. And that's the kind of thing that they'll do to a small person. With bigger people, they'll do either blackmail, or they'll gay up you. They'll say that you committed some crime, some financial crime, or you raped somebody. You know, they'll come up with something, and they'll pay somebody to be a witness. And you know, that's, you have to ask yourself though, with a guy like Massey, well, why isn't he going into the extreme? Why isn't he saying, it's not even extreme, why isn't he just saying the basic truth, all of the truth, you know? And you can't really, when you're in his position, you can't really go from saying just part of the truth to saying the whole truth. And if you did, you couldn't be trusted. It's because it's like the same thing.
They're saying he has a billionaire mega donor, Jeff Yass, who's Jewish, New York Jew. That's kind of, but the Jews always do this because, you know, Massey's not going to be able to turn that down, even if why would he want to? But Massey is going to be like one of these guys, and there's going to be a lot of these. AIPAC is bad, but not all Jews.
Yeah, and if you don't understand that, exactly. If you don't understand it's all Jews, then yes, you get your Jewish donor who's, I'm against AIPAC, or I'm against the ADL.
It's all a con, too.
It's all con. I mean, it's like the New York Young Republicans who got blown up by that one Jew who betrayed them all. It's like you're making jokes about Jews, and you don't think that the Jew that's in your group is going to betray you? Come on. And that's the thing about the left, too. You know, the left, some of them, I think, are starting to understand the Jewish question in and of itself, which is incredibly promising. But the ones who don't, the ones who are just kind of saying, well, it's just Zionism or it's not all Jews, you can't just be a leftist. You have to actually just become a National Socialist to even begin to form effective political opposition.
After October 7th, we had a bunch of the whole entire deal. We had a bunch of campus protests at very elite universities. And you had like the next generation of Council of Foreign Relations. You know, you got all these brown people that the Jews have let in, and all those brown people were adamantly opposed to Israel, and the Jews freaked out over that. What was your thinking? I thought that was actually hilarious.
Oh, it was great. I mean, that was awesome. And the Jews did what they were going to do, and they treated them all like terrorists. It was, you know, brown people, it was campus leftists, and, you know, not even a lot of campus leftists, kind of, there's a lot of intersection there with Antifa types. And the kind of people that are sort of used to being able to just do violence in the street, put on a mask and do whatever. And as they themselves say, they fucked around and found out. Now, I'm not going to stand here and laugh at them and be like, oh, yeah, lefties had it coming. Because the bigger issue here is that it just showed the Jewish system for what it is. And it's the Jews won't even allow a leftist opposition to them. And I will be mad at leftists who don't learn their fucking lesson. I will say that. It's like, yeah, you better learn your lesson, and you have to say, we're sorry for having oppressed anybody who attempted to point out the Jewish issue earlier. That's the biggest thing. Like, you see some leftists on Twitter nowadays who are being anti-Semitic, being anti-Zionist, all this stuff. And I'm like, I'm not okay with that. I think they owe us all an apology. And that's not just a petty thing. That's actually a much more practical, pragmatic thing. You can't just have oppressed anti-Jewish resistance and then change sides and not say, hey, I was wrong. Actually, I need to take a back seat and let other people kind of lead the way here because I was wrong and I was being a tool of the Jews, you know?
Yeah, so anti-Semitism is exploding. Who's another big name? We'll get your thoughts on Tucker Carlson. He's probably one of the more outspoken, out front. He's more aggressive than Massey, but he's also not in office. And what are your feelings about Tucker?
Well, what if Tucker ran for president?
I don't trust
president.
Any of these people because they're not on my side. But
yeah, well, what if Tucker ran for president, right? I guess my question is, how do I know that it's not going to be the same exact thing as Trump? Trump, I mean, looked, for all intents and purposes, to be have had a real legit change of heart or something, and yeah, he was saying things that was making the Jews mad. That's actually the measure right there. Does it make Jews mad? People will say, "Oh, it makes Jews mad." Therefore, he's doing the right thing. That's just part of it, though. The Jews will always and reflexively react to somebody criticizing them by getting mad, whether that person is an actual critic or whether they're a paid shill. The Jews will get mad because the Jews are always negotiating for their next deal. So if Jews get mad at somebody, that doesn't necessarily mean that they are a capable leader or even a non-controlled person. You know, you have lots of people on Twitter who are controlled by what's that Jew, Triple G, Double G, GG, whatever. That like gambling crypto Jew. There was a couple accounts like Myron Gaines, for instance, is associated with this guy. I don't know if you're familiar, but at any rate, you have people who are saying anti-Semitic things on the internet and criticizing Jews rightly, but they are clearly controlled, and then Jews get mad at them and people say, "Oh, look, the Jews got mad at him. He must be legit." No, that's not how it works. So it's the same thing with Tucker, in my opinion. If Tucker ran for president tomorrow, I would not be willing to support him until he has to show by his, going back to Hitler, by Hitlerian idealism, he has to prove that he is willing to face the brass knuckles of Antifa and face the possibility of being prosecuted or thrown in jail to show that he really is not controlled.
Yeah, the Tucker hasn't really been tested. I mean, even when Antifa shows up at your door, he's got millions and millions of dollars. He's extremely wealthy.
Right, and he would have been, he would be ruined. If he really was, I mean, he would be ruined. You know, there are plenty of people who got ruined after Charlottesville who have, have had multi-million dollar, hundreds of thousands of dollar default judgments against them.
Tucker's one of these guys where they could make deals with them and just say, "Look, we're going to have to take a back seat for a while to survive. This is our guy." You know, they have all these survival strategies. Now, the average Jewish leftist in Hollywood might be upset and whatever, but the ones that call the shots, the real ones, because they send on the foreign policy Jew that's he's kind of seems objective on Israel, and who's the one that goes on Tucker? I'm going to have to look it up here.
Is it Mark Levin or something?
It's not Mark Levin. Mark Levin doesn't get along with this guy. Hold on here. Let's see. Tucker. Let's see if I'm following him. I don't think
It's a foreign policy Jew.
Yeah, it's a foreign policy Jew. He was just on not that long ago. But Tucker has MTJ. This is the CIA guy going on everyone's show. This Greek CIA guy. Jeffrey Sachs. I knew it was right here. So Jeffrey Sachs is, let's look up Jeffrey Sachs. Now he's the one that is kind of positioned to be like a Tucker Carlson Jew, someone critical of Israel. American economist and public analyst. He's professor at Columbia University, which is formerly Earth Institute and Center for Sustainable Development. Okay. Jeffrey David Sachs, 71, Oak Park, Michigan. I didn't know that. That's definitely a Jewish area. Martin Feldstein, all right, Keynesian economics. All right. He was raised in Detroit. He's the son of Joan Abrams and Theodore Sachs. His family's Jewish. Okay, we know that. So he's kind of positioned as the moderate Jew, the Jew that's against Israel power over our foreign policy, this time.
Yeah, but you have to ask yourself though, why does this guy have this? Why is he a Columbia professor and you and I aren't?
Well, we know why.
I know, right.
But will our current system survive? Let's look at this. Have any legislators grown more powerful in the past decade? What will Israel do if the U.S. withdraws support? So this is Tucker's Jew. This is the Tucker Carlson Jew. This is this is the populist revolting wing we have to deal with. Tucker and this guy. But this is what they're positioning, right? Into this anti-Semitism we've been talking about. This is what they're positioning. Well, I guess I took down the piece, but and they're quite good at this because they have a lot of money, and white people are very nice.
Yeah, and it's you gotta ask yourself. It's not so much. It's not just what do people know. It's behind whom are they organized. So it's a matter of organization and leadership. And if you don't have that, if the leader is someone who is not able to stand up to the pressure or can be influenced by money or blackmail, it's money and blackmail are the two ways that Zod controls everything. There's zero honor or anything else like that. It's pure, it's naked. It's like prison rules. It's naked blackmail or bribery to control everyone. And if that isn't the case, then you can't trust the person. So we need actual opposition that isn't this.
I agree with you. We're on the same page. When it comes to Iran, because I want to talk about Iran a little bit more, then we want to talk about the book you're writing. Because you are an accomplished writer. You can write, but you don't write a lot anymore, do you? Or have you been?
I've been writing on Substack. So,
oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. I don't know. I've done maybe a couple dozen articles on Substack.
Are they pay-per-view? Because I'm always looking for Substack stuff to put on a site.
No, it's not pay-per-view. It's free. I will start doing some paid ones just because I need to stop being such a purist and make some damn money. But yeah,
Greg Conte Substack, because most of the Substack stuff I go to look to post for various different sites is pay-per-view, and I can't post it. Okay, Richard Wagner trashes Uncrit. Okay, so this gives me a new site. I got another Substack that isn't 100%. Well, it's not a lot of them are like one free, one pay-per-view, which isn't a big deal. I just trying to collect, like, where are all the good nationalists? They don't have to be like all on alignment, but where are all the good nationalists? Because Warren Baylog, when he writes, he does a pretty good article, and he writes on Substack, and he's also another one that's accessible that you can put up on sites that is not pay-per-view 100% of the time, and actually not at all. So, okay, so here's your Substack. That's very cool. Richard Wagner trashes uncreative, profit-thirsty Jew Meyer Beer. All right. Why I wrote my book. All right. We'll talk about the book here in a minute. When it comes to Iran, one of the things that concerns me is that what the Israelis, I would imagine they have God knows what positioned in North America. And I would imagine if they feel they have to do that, they'll go with some kind of crazy op, you know, I mean, and the fact of the matter is the Russians, the Chinese, everyone probably that wants something positioned in North America is already here with open borders and everything else. So you got the Israelis probably have something in every single state. They're probably
crazy. And sure. I mean, I was definitely thinking this as the Iran war was going hard. I was thinking, well, Zog needs to rally support behind it. And the propaganda doesn't seem to be working. They need a gay op. They need something to blow up that they can blame on the Iranians or they can blame on white nationalists.
Well, they got to do something to draft, because to go in there, you have to draft.
I mean, the draft, I'm not sure about that. That's a whole other issue. I don't think.
Or they need more. So, well, let's just agree on support for the war, because we won't know. Yes. We won't know anything about a draft until they do with the draft.
Yeah, the exact technical. How do you do it? You know, do you do a mass invasion? I think that's rather unlikely to do a mass invasion. I think they are smart enough to know they're not capable of that. They need to break up Iran the way they broke up Syria or something. They can't redo Iraq. I don't think even back in 2003 they could have invaded Iran with the army that they had then and actually beaten the Iranians. They could have really messed them up, sure, but I don't, you know, it's Iran's just, it's three times the size of Iraq. It's mountainous. It's, you know, it's that's a way bigger thing to deal with than Iraq.
They got miles of underground bunkers. They're heavily prepared for exactly this enemy.
Well, yeah, and now they're much more developed than they were 20 years ago, let alone 40 years ago when they were sending, you know, 13-year-old boys on bayonet charges against the Iraqis. They're much more developed than that now. So,
and Iran has all kinds of global support. They've got all probably who knows who's supporting them behind the scenes now that they've been successful against the empire that's hated. We're fucking hated all over the world. Yeah. Well, not us per se, but America now, because, you know, we're such tools.
Yeah, I've sort of adopted the custom of not saying we when I mean America.
Right. Zog.
I think it's really helpful.
Zog is the perfect word.
Yeah, exactly. Don't blame me for bombing Iran. I'm actually, you know, one of the few people, I'm one of the few Americans who's publicly and vociferously against it. But I think it's very healthy to not think of America as we. We are Americans we are white people within the Zog Empire, but we don't actually have any control over the aircraft carriers and the planes and the missiles.
Yeah, the war is very unpopular, so they got to get Americans on the side of the war. And the only way to do that is, in my opinion, some type of attack on American soil. I think we're thinking the same thing. The problem is that people are going to immediately think it's Israel, I think. And we're going to be pushing that. As soon as it happens, we're going to be like, well, who benefits from this? You know, it's going to be some shopping mall in Tennessee or something. I'm like, what? You know, like if Iran's going to attack someone after this skilled attack, why don't they just attack all the neocons at their houses or something?
Yeah, right. We are in beforeing it. The Iranians, I think, have been in beforeing it, too. They've been saying, maybe I'm just imagining that. But the Iranians have been very good in their rhetoric in also making that distinction between Zog and the American people. The one thing they're bad at is they'd sometimes say, like, oh, such and such Jew in America opposes the war. And it's like, don't do that, Iran. You're hurting people's understanding when you say that. But more or less, their rhetoric has been spot on and very good at reinforcing their legitimacy and undercutting Zog's legitimacy.
Yeah, I do. The you know, Putin actually made this distinction, too. And I have maybe some differences with Putin, but whatever. Not that I know them, but there's a big difference between the American people and the people who run the empire. The Iranians know that. I think the world's sophisticated enough to know that these dwindling number of white people in North America, you know, with this empire that's constantly barking at Europe for being too brown. I don't know how that works, though. You know,
Give me Finland's,
Sweden's numbers and Norway's numbers and even parts of Germany and France over America's numbers.
Well, they just do it to rally right-wing support behind Zog. They'll be like, oh, look at the Norwegians are so brown now. Aren't you glad you don't live in stupid Norway? What a bunch of idiots.
Yeah. Look, we have all these based H-1Bs.
Yeah, it's just laughable. I mean, I make common cause with the Norwegians. I think every serious person in America does. It's like, yeah, white Norwegians are us effectively. And so are the Germans and the French and the Italians, you know, everybody else in Western Europe. So
I've been pretty happy though. Europeans' response with America not doing well in the Iran war. I've been pretty happy with it. And it's not so much the presidents. The presidents in Europe have very little power, but their particular political apparatus has been kind of like sticking it to America. Yeah,
it's been promising that
Maloney, I don't know if it was actually Maloney or her advisors, but, you know, she got all in America shit on behalf of someone.
Maloney's a piece of shit, but.
Yeah, 100%. I'm talking about her confronting Trump and.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
poking him in the eye.
I think I would just read into it that. It just shows fractures happening within the empire. If the prime minister of Italy feels that she has to signal that she's anti-American, it's because the pressure is building up so much domestically that she has to do that. The same thing with the Spaniards.
And the Germans.
And the Germans, yeah. So it's promising, but you know, just people have to understand that when these things happen, it's a good sign, but don't like rally behind that person as a leader or something like that.
It doesn't mean shit. Yeah, it just means that they're having to play games, and various different assets are in play, meaning American
empire
assets.
Yeah, they're responding to pressure.
Italy did tell America they couldn't land in certain bases and stuff, and I don't know all the details about it, but it did pisses off the Jews. What do you think about Hungary and the election in Hungary with Viktor Orban, who was very, very Zionist, very Jew friendly, and replaced with a guy that it looks to be gay friendly, NATO friendly, Europe friendly, and kind of like, I don't think he's dangerous toward Israel, but he says he's going to arrest Netanyahu or some shit like that.
Yeah, it's just another one of those things that's
Hungary's not very significant on the world stage, yeah, other than it's somewhat symbolic, maybe.
Well, it just fault lines within the empire that are showing, and yeah, I mean, Hungary isn't terribly significant, but it is. It's a country that kind of could, its position, based on its geographic position and its history, it could kind of go with the Russians if it wanted to. Maybe not right now. I mean, Zog is too powerful in the region, but Hungary's always tried to play both sides, and because they, you know, are trying to maintain their national sovereignty. And I think you're going to see that increasingly in Eastern Europe as Zog's grip weakens. You'll start to see more nationalist, isolationist groups emerging in places in those countries. And Zog is going to have an increasingly difficult time in gay-opping those peoples into supporting the U.S. and supporting Zog.
Yeah, I saw that Victor Bout was on InfoWars, and I kind of followed Victor Bout on, I think I followed him on X, which is kind of crazy. You know, the Lord of War, or what is it? I think it's...
Yes. Wasn't he cellmates with Chris Cantwell for a little while?
Yeah, well, he kind of got to know
really
him. They were near each other back when That's Chris wild. Was straight. Whatever. Yeah. Whatever's going on with Chris. Hold on a second. Let me go over. Victor Bout was on, and he was saying that they expect... Where's Victor? Here he is, right here. They expect a rise of Nazism in Europe. Ideologically, Europe is on the verge of neo-Nazism spike. I mean, this has to be just something they do for, like, Russian audiences.
Because... Yeah. This is a peculiarity of the Russian mind. Whenever Russians talk about Nazis or fascists, it doesn't mean the same thing it means in the West. It, you know, they have this historical experience with the, you know, Operation Barbarossa and everything. And you'll see a Russian.
Stalingrad.
obviously, yeah. You know, you'll see a Russian use the word Nazi or fascisti to mean just, it's just like this vague idea in their head of like Westerners who want to attack us. It really has zero ideological import whatsoever. I mean, they'll call like, you know, they'll call the State Department flying the faggot, the rainbow flag of international faggotry outside the embassy. Oh, fascisti. But it just means person who is a threat to Russia. They're pretty loose about the use of the word, much in the same way that Antifa in the West is very loose about the word fascist. They'll use it to describe like anybody they don't like.
Yeah.
So it doesn't, I mean, yeah, I wouldn't read too much into it. People in the West are tempted to be like, oh, see, the Russians are thinking that there's going to be like a neo-Nazi this or that. It's like, no, they're just kind of, this is like a weird internal Russian domestic audience thing.
Yeah, it seems like they're constantly trying to appeal to their, I don't see them as openly pro-white per se. None of these guys are. This particular boomer crowd, none of them appear to be anywhere on the planet.
Yeah, I mean, Russians are weird. They'll be like adamantly proud about winning World War II, which, you know, fair enough. But then at the same time, they'll be like kind of cool with Germans. I mean, I spent a long time since I was in Russia and I didn't have too much experience talking to people, but just on like a kind of basic level, I feel like you'll have some Russians of a minority who are like adamantly anti-German, but for the most part, Russians are very open on the Germans and they're like over the war in a way that the Jews aren't, right? Like you're kind of not used to that in the West. You think of people from Europe or think of Jews and you like, oh, they're still mad about the war. The Russians aren't mad about the war. They're proud about winning it, but they're not like mad at the Germans for it.
No, they're white. I mean, the Slavs at least are. Well, St. Petersburg and Moscow do have their German populations too, or people from of German descent.
No, historically, there. Certainly. I don't know if they still do, but I
would imagine they'd be Slavic and mixed these days. But yeah, Victor Bout, the Lord of War, and pontificating. He was traded for that Brittany Grimes, which
oh,
is hilarious.
That's right.
You know, as soon as they arrested that tall black chick, you know, Victor Bout was dancing in a cell. I'm going home. They got that crazy black bitch. They're going to trade me.
That was the funniest thing. Like, oh, we found marijuana in your bag. You have to go to court now. And then trade. I mean, think about what a joke of a country the U.S. is, where a black basketball player S is an acceptable hostage for a international arms dealer.
It's absolutely funny. It's the funniest thing ever. It's absolutely hilarious. But it's what a joke, because here you have this black Brittany, what's her, Grimes or whatever.
Griner,
and many
I
people think
yeah.
she's a man. I don't know what she is. She's like some super, super tall black, a women's NBA player. She's got all kinds of money. Sounds like a man when she talks. She's in Russia. She has some kind of vape, some kind of marijuana vapes, or I forget what it was. They arrested her, and next thing you know, she's in some prison. She has to shave off her dreads, and it's like the end of the fucking world to the administration. And Victor Bout's just dancing. He's dancing home to Russia. He's free. Yeah, this badass Lord of War and everything. They're making all these movies about him. I bet he has some crazy stories, though.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Especially arms dealing across Africa. That'd be wild shit. But anyways, talk about your book. Why I wrote my book. What's up with this book you're writing? Tell us about it.
So I published it back in August with Invisible Empire Publishing. And
Invisible Empire.
It's called Be a Hero, Revolution by Legal Means. The original title was Be a Hero, A People's Guide to Dismantling Systemic Jewish Power, I think. But a friend of mine talked me out of using such a ridiculously long title. But what it is it's like, okay, so you know the Jews control America. What do you do now? That's the premise of the book. And so I take it from, I talk about some of my experiences. I kind of loosely weave it around that, but I mostly do analysis and discussion of the alt-right, and then the need for a strong ideology in order to actually oppose Jewish power, why that has to be National Socialism, why it can't be anything else, and the historical and philosophical reasons for that. And then I go on and talk. I spent about a third of the book or a quarter of the book talking about lawfare, specifically my experience in it, other people's experience in it. And then I go on and talk a little bit more about sort of bigger political stuff and ethnic groups and everything. But, you know, on the lawfare stuff, the reason I focus on that so much is because you can't have a political movement. You can't have a real opposition unless you can have a political meeting or a street demonstration. And you can't have a political meeting or a street demonstration if you're going to get sued because some Antifa comes up to you and spits in your face or throws something at you or starts attacking you, and you just like actually hit them back. You know, you can't, if you can't exercise basic self-defense in the street, you know, the law says you can, but for all intents and purposes, you can't. Then you have to figure out
those over self-defense.
Yes. You have to figure out, okay, well, how do we stop losing in court? And it isn't just a mere thing of like raising enough money and getting enough lawyers to do it right, because the other side, the ADL, the SPLC, are always going to have more lawyers than you. They're going to have more money, and they're also going to have the sympathy of the Jewish press. So you're going to have to do it in a way that is at least economically, you're not spending more money than them. Because a lot of times the point of a lawsuit isn't even to throw you in prison. It's just to waste your time. Even if they don't win, they're just willing to spend a ton of money to waste your time and stress you out. And it's very stressful to be in those situations. So I spent a lot of time talking about that, and, you know, the lessons I've learned about court and how you have to fight it effectively, and not just on a technical level, but much more importantly on a moral level, how you have to get inside the head of the person that's coming after you and the jury, eventually the judge, all that stuff.
Okay. So, basically the book is out.
Yeah, it's out.
83.87. Is that the price?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
It's a big fat book. It's 150,000 words. It's like, your typical nonfiction book is like 60 or 80.
Why didn't you make
words.
It $80 to $88.88?
I don't know. It's just Amazon, whatever.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay.
We've played around with the pricing, but it's in before the objection that I'm grifting, I have spent way, way more money and lost way, way more money on this movement than I'm ever going to recoup from this book, unless it becomes
a
bestseller, I guess.
That's 100% true. It would have to sell a million copies or something, or, well, maybe not, maybe 100,000 copies.
Yeah, it'd have to sell a lot, but yeah. you're getting your money's worth.
You can get the ebook, although I don't like ebooks, for $30.
You can get the ebook. I like hardcover books myself.
I think hardcover is always the way to go. It is a hardcover, or is it soft cover?
It is hardcover. I would like to release a soft cover.
It's an interesting picture on the front cover.
Oh yeah, well that was the Amazon edition has that cover. The original version has an outline of Hitler. The Amazon cover is Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, the German poet, literateur of circa 18.
How many pages is this book?
470.
Okay. And how many chapters is it?
39.
Okay, so they're small chapters then.
They're about, most of the chapters are about 4,000 to 5,000 words.
Okay. So it goes through your whole entire worldview.
Yeah. And I tried writing it initially more as a treatise, just really dry third person objective. And then I've never written a book like this before. I've never written at such length before. And so, I decided, you know what, I'm going to do the thing where I just kind of loosely weave it around my own experiences. And it's always easier to write about yourself. And so I can kind of introduce some stories from Charlottesville and stuff like that, or courtroom stories that I think you'll find amusing.
I'm actually going to buy the book. I almost spent $80 on your book.
Thank you.
Just to see it. I think it looked good on a coffee table. Obscure National Socialist Writers.
Well, that's the other reason that I it's priced rather high, is I want people to actually read it. Like, if you're, don't just use it as a decoration, actually read it.
Yeah. I'm trying to draw in the crowds for you, Greg, but if you're into unique nationalists and National Socialist Writers, Greg Conte would definitely be one that I would pay for just to see what all is in it. Plus, it's not, I mean, you pay $30 for a book anyways, you're dealing with double, triple, 2.5 times the cost for someone that's been through a lot of shit. And it's a form.
Yeah. I mean, when we initially published it on with Invisible Empire on their website, and they got debanked in 2 weeks,
Oh, Invisible Empire, huh?
Yeah. But we did get it on Amazon, so we'll see how long that lasts.
I'll have to order it from Amazon before they go away. So I'll order it in the next week, or maybe in the next couple of days, I'll grab it from Amazon. Be a hero. Yes. So that's kind of interesting. So this came out, and I this is the first I've heard about it. You've always been a writer, though. You wrote for how many different publications? Did you write for National Public?
I've written some articles for Occidental Observer.
Right.
I've written some for Russia Insider. I've written some for.
Didn't you write for the altright.com?
A little bit, maybe. I think some of my stuff might have gotten cross published there, or okay, or whatever. But
yeah,
not.
You used
not,
to write
so much
quite
them.
A bit. Back in the height of all.
Oh, well, back in 2015, 2016, we had a website, me and some buddies, called Atavistic Intelligentsia, and wrote some travel stories there. I went through Europe in 2016 and wrote some some travel adventures about seeing all the migrant invasion of Europe and what that was all like. I went around Sweden and Germany and Italy and Greece and saw all that. And it was, yeah, that was awful. But.
Okay. Be a Hero, Revolution by Legal Means. And I'm guessing how many different chapters are on just your legal episode? Because that's quite a victory. Quite a victory.
It's about a quarter. There's a quarter of it is on the alt-right. A quarter of it is on national socialism and the problems of Americanism and some other minor kind of ideological problems. And then the last quarter is a quarter on the legal stuff, and then another quarter on kind of big picture, like how do you build a movement and trying to apply Hitler's principles from from Mein Kampf to American conditions. Because I think that's really the book I wanted to write, but I realized I have to lay out all this other stuff before we can even get to applying Hitler. And that's sort of the problem is, we just don't have yet a big enough block of people who understand enough to have a meeting of the minds about how things are done. So that's why I wrote a book. I mean, and, you know, the question is like, why don't you just go do it? It's like, well, we need more people to understand things at a higher level, and then we can start to really do it. So.
Okay. So it is, there's a lot of people out there that read Hitler or they read Mein Kampf, but they don't really make an attempt to, they try to redo the 30s, but we're not in the 30s, modern America. I mean, you actually had some hard asses in Germany at the time. And I don't know how many hard asses you have in America right now. Maybe you'd get quite a number of white hard asses of some economic hard times.
You know, but there are compensating factors though, right? Like, okay, this is a true observation. There are a lot of hard asses back then. But at the same time, the penalties in this country are far lower. Like, we're dealing with kind of...
Yeah, we don't have to spell out. We don't have to spell out Jewish names. Like,
generally a lower level of violence. Like, doxing somebody or suing them is generally enough to shut them up. And in many cases, it's even less than that. It's just a knock on the door from the FBI, or it's just a threat of doxing. And so, you know, you're dealing with violence at a much lower level, but it's still the same dynamic between the revolutionary elements and the system. And you know, some other observations of Hitler. You know, people often say about Weimar Germany, like, well, the people then were getting so radical because things were so bad economically, and things aren't bad economically here. And that is a true observation, but I don't think it's, first of all, it doesn't defeat all of Hitler's insights. Many of his insights are still extremely valuable, such as the one enemy principle, the idea that you have to focus on one thing. You can't go out there and say, well, we have all these blacks, all these Hispanics, we have all these Jewish corporations. You have to kind of unify all of those things under one thing. And really, you know, you don't just pick somebody at random. You don't just say, well, we hate black people, let's just make a movement about that. Well, we hate Muslims, let's have a movement about that. No. You have to have it based on the people that actually are in power. And so that's obviously Jews. That's why Hitler talks about Jews so much. And if you read, you know, Mein Kampf, you read Hitler's articles, you read his speeches, he's always ordering his information in that way. He's always ordering it, okay, we have this problem in the Ruhr with the French. Well, here's how this relates to international finance and the Jews. We have this problem with the Treaty of Versailles. Okay, well, how does that relate to the Jews? You know, he's always bringing it back. We have this problem with communism. But what is that? Well, that's Jews taking control of our own urban working class and brainwashing them in communism and then appointing themselves as commissars, as leaders of this anti-national movement. So like Hitler's always bringing back on those things. And, you know, another one of the things about Mein Kampf that is different from today, but is still applicable, just applicable a little bit differently, is back then you had a large blue collar working class in the cities, and you don't have that in America today. And you haven't had it since about the 60s, since they brought in blacks into the cities and did integration and pushed all the whites out. And I think Zog did that very intentionally, because they were worried that if you have a big urban working class of whites, or you have Lithuanians and Poles in Chicago, well, now George Lincoln Rockwell can show up and organize those people. And that's going to be a problem. So, you know, you have to think about ways to get around the problems, but at the same time, Hitler's insights are fundamental. And one of his, and the reason it's called Be a Hero is because one of Hitler's biggest things is you can't renounce heroes. You can't renounce, you can't like have a movement where you say, well, Hitler was a bad guy, but blah, 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 blah. That's actually like, people think that's smart, but it's actually just renouncing one of your biggest sources of power, which is acknowledging these great examples from the past. That's what drives your movement, is having these great heroes and great ideas.
Okay. All right, folks, that is Greg Conte. You can grab his book. You can check him out on Substack. You can find him at the Telegram link, which is always up and at it. And I appreciate you coming on and being a good sport. Any last words, Greg? Anything you want to
Thanks a lot for having me on, Tim. I really appreciate it. I always enjoy the conversation. Love talking about international affairs, and you give me the chance to speculate on what might happen with Iran, talk a little bit about the Middle East. And yeah, it's good stuff. It's exciting. And I do think that, you know, people should be, I don't want to say optimistic, because optimism is for cowards, as Oswald Spengler said, but you should see that there's a way out of this. There is a way out. We can do it. We can actually win back our sovereignty for white people in America and the Western world broadly. And the key is, you have to overthrow Jewish power, and you have to work for it. So, and to work, you have to learn, you have to understand first, then you have to fight, then you can win.
I do appreciate you coming on and being a good sport, and I look forward to having you on again, and I'm going to get your book, see what I think of it.
I appreciate it.
I appreciate it, you guys. And this is the look at his book again. That looks like doesn't exactly look like a book cover I would think Greg Conte would be behind. The color and everything else, the first one you mentioned with Hitler, I could see. But I do understand the German context of it, but the coloring, I'm like, I like it.
My publisher was playing around with it. He was showing me some options. I was like, you got to make it you got to make it really like out there. You got to make it people. It needs to grab people's attention, both on Amazon and on the shelf. People got to be looking along a shelf of books and say, what is that purple thing?
I appreciate you coming on, and guys, I'll be back Sunday at 5:30, and definitely support Greg. His link is in the description. And hold on, let me put up a link. I'm going to put up a link to his book. Hold on here. Let me make sure I got the right link here. Okay. I had that. Put up a link to his book here, and definitely grab it and check it out. Put the link up across the board. You guys had a little bit of extra money, order some books. At least you're supporting someone that's it's always been in the cause, always has something interesting to say, and always has unique insights. And there you guys go. I do appreciate it, Greg, and thanks again for being a good sport and coming
on. Thank you again. It's always a pleasure, Tim.
Cheers. Guys, I'll be back Sunday. Take care and have a good weekend.